yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, Dark 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Wow, this is the week that was, or is, not over yet. Quite a week. Confirming what I've been predicting for over a year now was on the agenda. I don't even know where to start. There's so much information and developments here worth noting. But let's just do a little overview, maybe, as a way, and then jump into three topics I want to focus on. One is what's called the dash for cash. What is that? That means to hold money balances, cash assets. You see, cash is an asset like every other asset. You know, if you own property, that's an asset. If you own stock, that's an asset. You own a factory or a business, that's an asset. You know, bonds, those are assets. Real property are assets. But so is cash is an asset. And at the risk of becoming maybe too economic theorist, all assets are substitutable, meaning as an investor, I can exchange one for the other. But they have different characteristics. You see, if I'm holding cash, I'm not going to lose money. Especially if all other assets and prices are falling. I'm actually going to appreciate the value of my cash. Other assets may be collapsing in value. Oh, I'm losing when my stocks plummet, or the value of my mortgage or property collapses. So I want to hold cash if I'm an investor. You know, households do this too. I want to hold the cash. I want to get out of those assets that are collapsing and get into cash, which isn't and actually maybe rising in real terms. This is the dash for cash that's going on right now, this week, by investors, by corporations. And it's a sign of a pending credit crisis. This rush to liquidity. Liquidity is a spectrum of condition. In other words, cash is purely liquid. In economist terms, that means I can exchange my cash for anything. I can buy anything with my cash. I can't buy anything with my car or my house. I got to sell it first for cash, you see. It's not liquid. Liquidity is a term used that in economics and finance that refers to having cash, an asset that's absolutely substitutable with all other assets immediately. So businesses are rushing, dashing for cash, investors. Why are they doing that? Because their other investments, their other assets are collapsing in value. So they want to get out of it. They want to sell those for cash, and get into cash. Well, that's a consequence of collapsing financial asset markets and investment markets everywhere. The dash for cash is an indication of a pending credit crisis. Now, you got to understand, that's the next step or phase from a financial asset deflation going on worldwide. What's been happening? Well, we know the stock markets are collapsing. They're down, what, 25%? You know, they have days when they bounce up a little, but if you notice, you know, the buying the dip by investors and the bounce back is weaker than the collapse down in the preceding sessions and days. So it keeps ratcheting lower and lower. Business confidence, consumer confidence are plummeting. People want to hold cash. Why do businesses want to hold cash? Well, because they know that the sales of their products are collapsing as well. The real economy is collapsing. Because of the coronavirus, which precipitated, didn't cause it, it precipitated the downturn. The economies were growing, were getting very weak already last year. The U.S. economy was just being held up by the consumer and consumer spending, part of which was at the high end consumers feeling a wealth effect from their rising stock prices. And in the middle and below, people loading up on credit card debt and other forms of debt. So that was holding everything up because real investment was contracting 9 months last year. And of course, the trade thing, because of Trump's trade war, wasn't doing so well either. But now you've got even further contraction going on this quarter of business investment plummeting, falling through the floor. At the same time, now you got a crash. Well, not a crash, but a real contraction going on in consumer spending. People are staying home. You know, they're not traveling. They're not going to hotels. They're not going to restaurants. The whole, you know, the markets, the real markets for real goods and services are falling like 10 pins here. People just aren't spending anymore. Watch the numbers for consumer spending coming out of the first quarter. They'll be dramatic. And what's the next shoe that drops? Well, when businesses know that all of a sudden they can't expect sales revenue, their profits will fall. That's why they're rushing into cash, in other words. And then they're going to start laying off in about another month or two if this continues. Then you will see another major impact on consumer spending. You see how one thing touches the other in sequence here, and it all spirals down. So we're in a recession now. This summer, when the elite economists that belong to what's called the National Bureau of Economic Research, a quasi-government body, gather, this is the group that determines whether we had a recession or not, or in or out of recession. They do it with a lag. They will almost certainly rule or decide that we went into recession in March. You know, even Goldman Sachs is forecasting second quarter zero growth for the U.S., zero GDP. Well, I think they're being polite and diplomatic. They don't want to be at first to say, well, it's going to be a recession, negative growth. So they say zero growth. But, you know, that's an indication that it'll be negative. And what about China? Well, most economists are forecasting China's official 6% growth rate, which is always overestimated by at least 2%. It's really about 4%, is going to fall first quarter to somewhere between a positive 2 to a negative 2. In other words, stagnant as well as the U.S. That's half of the world's economy, China and the U.S., at stagnant zero growth at best and likely less contracting. At the same time, what do you got in the real economy? You got Japan, already 7% contraction going on. They were already in recession fourth quarter because of stupid moves on raising sales taxes over there. Italy, Germany in recession. Australia now in recession. South Korea in recession. Commodity producing nations, economies in recession, oil, Latin America, excuse me. Okay, so we got a global real recession going on, and overlaid on that, we have financial asset markets plummeting everywhere, one after the other. We have a synchronization going on globally in both the real markets, the real economies, and in the financial side. And they're feeding back on each other. You know, I got to laugh when I read some of these economists trying to, you know, in the Wall Street Journal elsewhere saying, oh, no, this is not 2008. This is different. Well, they were all saying that in 2008, too. It's different, but it's similar. I just wrote a piece. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, or go to Counterpunch, you know, where I talk about the global financial asset deflation underway. Is this the next, quote, great recession, unquote? And then today, that was earlier in the week, today publishing a piece here commenting on Trump's disastrous dead on arrival TV address here a couple of days ago, and the economy, global U.S. financial real, continuing in its downward spiral, and my own proposals for fiscal stimulus. I'm going to go over those a little bit here today, you know, because that's what's being focused on now. Trump came out with his disastrous minimalist response, and I think it was Wednesday, maybe it was Thursday, things moving so fast, and of course, the markets took that with a thud and dropped 2,200 points. The Dow dropped 2,200 points. That's what the markets and business think of his proposal. Oh, now he's regrouping, and indications are some sort of emergency measures, declaring a national emergency. Watch out for that. I think that's going to be used somehow to protect him politically, not just economically. You know, we know that Donald Trump is not all that enamored with democracy. But we'll see how that rolls out. In the meantime, the Democrats in Congress, you know, are passing some measures, in the House at least, and the Senate, McConnell, is poo-pooing it and delaying it. Meanwhile, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of American workers and households are not going to work, either because they're ill or they're told not to by their employer. That's going to be a disaster for them, too. I wrote a piece in the middle of the week called COVID-19 and the working class, how they're being hit. And by the way, how Trump's proposals said nothing about that. What did Trump say in his TV address for the households, for working class households? Well, I'll tell you what he said. Quote, relief coming soon, unquote. And then he turns around and proposes tax cuts for businesses, you see. But even that for businesses was a flop. Look, when everyone's dashing for cash and worried about being able to pay their bills if they're households, or if they're businesses, being able to pay the massive run-up in corporate debt that has occurred the last 10 years. You see, that's what part of Dash for Cash is. They've got to get this cash in hand because their revenues are going to fall because of the economy contracting, but their debt does not go away. And they better pay that principal and interest on their debt, because if they don't, they default. And if they default, then the vultures take them over. And they know that. So they're gathering as much cash as they can by what? Drawing down their credit lines with the banks. Drawing down means, okay, a bank has told me I got $2 billion. Let's take Boeing. Boeing has $13.5 billion credit line with the banks. In other words, they can withdraw that, take that out. The bank agrees to give them 13.5 banks a billion, and they don't have to take it all at once, but it's sitting there. They can draw it down when they want. They're drawing it all down. They're all rushing to draw down their credit lines. In other words, go to the banks, they give me cash. I want to put it on my balance sheets because I may need it to pay my debt, principal and debt. So think about that. I'm going to take on more debt to pay my old principal and debt because I won't have a cash flow here from revenue, from selling of my goods because we're in a recession. Does that sound crazy? Yeah, it is. But it's a fact. And that's how financial crashes start, you see. You have a period of a long buildup of corporate debt, and over $10 trillion has been built up in corporate debt in the U.S. alone. I'm not even talking about bank loan debt. And that $10 trillion is just the Fortune 500. $10 trillion in corporate debt rolled up over the last 11 years. Well, many of them, you know, were taking out all that corporate debt, issuing corporate bonds, because they could, because it was so cheap. What they had to pay in interest was so cheap when they borrowed that money. And it was so cheap because the Federal Reserve was pumping free money into the economy for years, 7 years. The Fed ultimately set the crisis, you see. The banks were bailed out in 2010, but the Fed kept zero interest rates. Well, 0.1% interest rates. Banks could borrow at 0.1%. They went out and loaned it to their clients, their non-bank clients, who loaded up. Many of them borrowed money from the banks, who got it for free from the Fed, in order to pay their shareholders. How? Stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's how. On average, $1 trillion a year for 10 years, about $800 billion a year under Obama, but now under Trump, $1.2 trillion for the last 2 years each. Free money. Well, with Trump, it was big tax cut money for investors and businesses. You see, we're subsidizing the capitalists now with tax cuts and free money. This is 21st century capitalism. The typical tools for trying to deal with a crisis or deep recession, i.e. fiscal policy, tax cut spending, and on the other hand, low interest rates from the Federal Reserve, those typical tools no longer function as they were intended as stabilization tools, economic stabilization. No, they become capitalist subsidization tools. We've given $15 trillion to businesses since George W. Bush in tax cuts. Obama just as bad as George Bush and Donald Trump. Each of them, you know, $4 to $6 trillion each during their terms in office. Well, there's three-fourths of your national debt, $22 trillion. Plus, of course, massive increases in defense war spending for these silly wars in the Middle East. Wars for oil that the U.S. doesn't need anymore because it's self-sufficient in oil. Why didn't they just, you know, pump their own oil instead of going defending, you know, the monarchy there in Saudi Arabia? Oh yeah, that's another story. Massive debt, corporate debt, run up partly because the Fed made interest rates so cheap and they're all borrowing to pay stock buybacks and dividend payouts of $1 trillion a year or more. Well, there's your income inequality at the top, the 1%. You hold wages, real wages constant, you know, and they give everybody part-time temp jobs. you know, for the working class, and then you just write these checks unlimited for the 1% investor class, and the income gap grows as a result. Yeah. Okay, so they just didn't borrow this $10 trillion in corporate bonds in order to refinance or redistribute to their shareholders. No. Some of them borrowed because they had to, because their companies were really on the rocks, or they wanted to expand so fast and they don't have the revenue yet, they borrowed. Well, that's what happened with the fracking companies, you see. And if the company was not a solid company and probably should have gone out of business, mismanaged or whatever, they could still get loans because it was so cheap, but they had to pay higher interest rates. Those were called junk bond or high yield corporate loan bonds. Now, there's an analog to that junk on the bank loan side. They're called leverage loans. So you got companies borrowing, i.e. issuing corporate bonds in order to pay their shareholders, and you got companies borrowing in order to stay afloat, all because it's so cheap. The money is so cheap that the Fed insured. And now we got $2 trillion in the U.S. of junk bond debt, corporate debt, $2 trillion. And there's another $3 trillion, by the way, of what's called near junk bond debt. They're called triple B corporate, investment grade, triple Bs, you see. That's another $3 trillion. But half of that $3 trillion double triple B is really junk bond that got reclassified improperly so that the companies could raise the debt, raise credit. Okay, so you got $5 trillion of corporate debt in this country at risk. Well, what do I mean at risk? Well, let's take the example of the fracking companies. A lot of small, medium-sized companies borrowed a lot of money by issuing junk bonds. Now, they have high interest and a lot of principal that they got to pay so that they don't default. You see, if you don't pay principal and interest, you default. If you default, then the banks can take you over. So what do these fracking companies got to do? Well, they got to pump more and more oil in order to raise the revenue to pay the rising principal and interest on their debt. But what happens when the price of oil drops to $30 or $25 below, right? What happens then? Well, their revenue sharply contracts when the price of their oil contracts. Well, that means they got to pump even more, right? Even with sell even more volume when the price declines. And that's what they've been doing. 13 million barrels a day being pumped by U.S. oil gas fracking industry, more than the Saudi Arabia. Last month, Saudi Arabia pumped 9.7 million a day. The Russians about 11 million barrels a day. U.S. 13 million barrels a day, causing an oversupply in the global market because the demand for oil is slacking because of slowing global economy. At the same time, the U.S. frackers are pumping all this oil into the global economy, further depressing oil prices. And then you get this guy Bin Salman over there in Saudi Arabia saying, oh, hey, you know, we got to do something about this. We're no longer going to try to prop up the price because that's just playing into the hands of the fracking companies in the U.S. We got to drive them out of business. That's our only solution. Oh, and they look like they're pretty fragile now over there because they're loaded up with this junk debt. So let's drop the price, Bin Salman says. And that's what happened. And that throw fuel on the fire, oil on the fire, pun intended, of the financial asset market decline. Because oil is a financial asset, not just a physical commodity. Oil futures. You know, when you see these prices rise and fall in oil, that's oil futures prices. And that's what's happening, you see. On top of it, we got a crash in global oil prices. Well, when that happens, the junk bond companies in the U.S. in the energy and oil industry, their prices fall. They have less revenue. And guess what? They got less to pay the principal and interest on their rising junk bond debt. That's happening right now. Pretty clear. You got dozens of these guys who are on the road to default. They're in negotiations right now with their banks. Default. Now remember, there's $2 trillion and $3 trillion triple Bs. That's $5 trillion in this very shaky junk debt. Well, at least $3 to $4 trillion. And when they start the default, puts the fear in other non-energy junk bond holders. Who are they? Well, retail companies, you know, like JCPenney's and others, loaded up because they've been in trouble. Amazon's been eating their lunch. Their revenue has been dropping, so they keep borrowing. Sears is a classic example of that, right? First to go under. Penny's will be next. Maybe Macy's. All the big box retailers in deep trouble. Well, they loaded up on a lot of junk debt, too, to stay alive here the last several years. Well, they're going to have trouble. And right behind them, you know, come the hotels and resorts, cruise lines, maybe some airlines, although they've fattened their coffers pretty well in recent years. They're all holding junk too. And the panic will spread from the energy company junk bond holders to the retail to travel and entertainment and other holders of that $5 trillion. Other businesses see this coming. They see the shutdown of consumption coming because of what's going on with the coronavirus, which is just a precipitating cause, you see. Coronavirus isn't the cause of all this. It's a precipitating cause. Things have been building up. And the real and financial sectors have become increasingly fragile. Fragile meaning you can tip them over pretty easy. And then, of course, here comes the bug, and it does just that. Disrupt supply chains and therefore production and output that could be sold for revenue to service debt. And then on the demand side, consumers not buying. So supply chains, supply shock, consumers staying home, losing their jobs out of fear, not spending unless they're buying toilet paper. That's going to hit the bottom line of a lot of sales of a lot of companies. So they're taking a double whammy. Companies are taking a double whammy here. You know, supply chain problems, not just China, but Japan and South Korea and everywhere else. Disrupted, severed some cases. Auto companies, same thing. You see, U.S. multinational corporations under neoliberalism went offshore. Took their good jobs, moved them offshore. I.e. move the supply chains offshore, producing intermediate goods offshore, then sending them back to the U.S. to be assembled or sold here in the U.S. That's why you got free trade ever since, you know, the 1989 free trade. That was so U.S. multinational corporations that moved offshore could ship the stuff back and not pay a tariff. That's what free trade is about. Oh, and the tax system encouraged them to move it offshore. Yeah, they got tax cuts, investment tax cuts, if they produced offshore. Oh, all kinds of incentives, tax and other incentives, to move offshore. Okay, so the supply chains moved offshore, and now they can't get the stuff onshore to assemble. Auto companies are a good example. You know, most of this stuff is made offshore, and then they just put the parts together here in the U.S., just assembly autos. It's not a production auto company industry anymore. Yeah, most of it's, you know, in Mexico or in, you know, Brazil and other places. Okay, so those supply chains have been broken. And now we got a demand shock on top of the supply shock. But now we got the other channel, and that's the financial asset channel. As it collapses, as financial assets collapse, the dash for cash, in order to keep paying the principal and interest on the debt that they accumulated over 10 years, partly to raise funds to buy back their stock and pay out dividends. You see how crazy it is? It's all linked, but it's crazy. It's crazy. Capitalism is crazy. And that's what we're looking at now. Once again, you know, the crash in 2008, what was that? Oh, that was housing, subprime mortgages, and derivatives, you know, held by insurance company AIG, Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, you know, Fannie Mae, all of that, WaMu, Washington Mutual, you know, all overextended in debt in the housing industry. But then what really sent it into a tailspin was the credit default swaps by AIG, which are like insurance contracts that AIG would have to pay all the investors who held those insurance contracts, betting that Lehman Brothers and the others would not collapse. Well, when they let them collapse, then all the investors got in line with AIG and said, hey, okay, we bet that they would collapse. Now pay up AIG. And of course, AIG wrote too many of these contracts, more than it had money to pay, because it never believed it would happen, but it did happen. And then the government had to bail out AIG, $180 billion. Well, then that financial crash just spilled over to the real economy, oftentimes through financial conduits like the finance companies for the auto sector. Oh, I'm talking about General Motors Acceptance Corp, the finance company for General Motors. That bought subprime housing mortgages. Yeah, auto company finance buying mortgages. Yeah. Well, when they lost their shirt there, they dragged down GM and the auto companies, and we had to bail them out. Okay, so that was 2008. What you got was a debt, an asset in housing, and derivatives like CDSs, credit default swaps, exacerbating, leading to a industry-wide credit crunch. In other words, credit froze up. You couldn't get credit anywhere. Even if you're a good company and not in trouble, you couldn't get it. The banks froze up. There's no liquidity, no credit to be got anywhere. And of course, then that spills over into the real economy, which it did. You know, we're losing a million jobs a month for 6 months as the real economy then join the financial crash. You see, there's a linkage between the financial crash and the real economy. And financial cycles built upon high levels of speculation and debt and the real economy, where you don't have sufficient wage income growth and you make the households fragile. And this is important, listen, the mechanism that connects them is the credit crunch. The credit crisis, which is a crisis of liquidity, the lack of liquidity, the lack of cash. That's why businesses are dashing for cash, you see, because they know liquidity is drying up. That's how the two sides of the capitalist economy, financial side and the real side, are connected through the credit system and the credit crunch. And that follows a financial asset implosion, deflation. Well, we got the financial asset implosion, don't we? We got it in stocks. We got it in currencies. You know, we got it in bonds now. We got it in oil commodity futures. It's generalized. It's synchronized. It's globalized going on. The next step is the credit system, the credit crash. We're not quite there yet, but there are really disturbing signs of, yeah, we're on the precipice of that. Well, let me tell you what some of these signs, these indicators are of a liquidity crisis. In other words, not enough cash to refinance the debt, their debt, their record debt, $10 trillion debt. They've run up. Corporations. You see, the problem this time is in the non-financial corporate sector. It's not in the housing sector. It's similar in process, but, you know, the content is different. But it's the same thing. It's debt and the inability to finance that debt. In other words, to pay the principal and interest on that debt. You know, a lot of people on the left and progressives talk, oh, just the magnitude of debt. Oh, it's so much debt. Yeah, yeah. But that's only half the story, you see, because the real problem is not just the magnitude of debt, but the inability to pay the principal and interest on it. And that principal and interest payment problem begins when your cash flow collapses, when you can't sell your products to generate revenue in order to continue paying your principal and interest. It's okay to run up your debt as long as, you know, your revenue keeps rising, your sales keep rising, and the prices of your products keep rising. Then where you generate cash, liquidity, in order to keep financing your rising debt. But, you know, the cycle never goes on in the real economy of rising sales and rising prices forever. This thing called business cycle. And when that contracts, well, your revenue contracts. Oh, but your debt doesn't. You see, that's the big difference. Now you're in a credit crunch. Oh, you got to go and get more liquidity from the banks. More loans from the banks. Well, at a certain time, the banks may not roll over their loans to you, or investors may not buy your corporate bonds because you're such a shaky company. Oh, and then you are facing default. And when enough businesses and industries default, it sends a business confidence shudder throughout the industry, all industries. And then all of them say, oh, well, gee, this is imminent, might happen to me. I better draw down my credit lines from the banks and get the money and put it on my books now, just in case, you see. And that's what's going on. That's an indication. The massive sell-off of all these assets that are dropping in value, these financial assets, is an indicator of this dash for cash, or in other words, the need for liquidity to protect against the collapsing revenue that's coming, so that you can keep paying the principal and interest on your debt and don't have to go bankrupt and default. So markets selling off everywhere are an indication. And then we've got these big investor shadow bankers, you know, like Carlyle Group and Blackstone, saying this week to their business, corporate business clients, saying, draw down your credit lines, boys, because it's coming. And, you know, the banks authorized that much, and they gave it to them. They had to draw it down. But now the bankers are getting together, you see, and they're saying, oh, what are we going to do about this? They had a meeting this week, you know. Oh, wait a minute. They're going to take our money, and they're going to be in good shape for a while. But what about us? We better figure out a way not to let them draw down all that credit line we've authorized for them. So the banks are starting to hoard their cash. Oh, And then you get this problem in the repo market on top of it, another indicator. What's the repo market? We've talked about that at times, you know, but what is the repo market? Well, the repo market is a market where the Federal Reserve buys and sells bonds to intermediaries, financial intermediaries, hedge funds and banks, you know, who then use the bonds, the treasury bonds, as collateral to loan each other money. But there's not enough cash in the repo market now. Ah, liquidity is drying up in the repo market. That's why the Fed, in an amazing announcement this week, announced it was pumping $1.5 trillion this week into the repo market so that the banks could have enough money in order to what? Guess. Allow the credit lines to be drawn down. There's not enough money in the repo market. So the Federal Reserve is pumping in trillions in 1 month and 3 month repos. Usually it's overnight repos, you know, or 48 hours or, you know, 1 week repos. But now it's 1 month, 3 months. $1.5 trillion. I've seen estimates that said that by various means, not just the repo market, but other means, that the Fed has pumped in $5 trillion since the beginning of the year into the economy. Well, why all that liquidity? Because they need the liquidity, you see, or they want the liquidity as a hedge and protection for their collapsing sales and real side of the economy, so that they can keep paying all this massive debt they run up. Now, the Fed, also today I read, has given the green light to banks to loan out more. You know, but the Fed is saying, wait a minute, you guys, don't pull in your horns, you know. They want their credit lines, and they need the money to pay the principal and interest on their debt in the junk bond markets. And, you know, so what you got to have to do, fellas, is loan them the money. And you know what we're going to do? The Fed says you can ignore all the Dodd-Frank financial stability law provisions that say you got to keep a buffer just in case you go under. You can loan your buffer out now. So much for protecting the banks. Yeah, that's what the Fed's saying. Give them a green light, right? To lend out their buffer because the demand for liquidity is so high, right? Now, here's a little economics 101, right? This demand for liquidity, dash for cash, whatever you want to call it, is called the liquidity preference. When you have a crisis like this, the financial assets collapsing everywhere, and investors want to get out of them everywhere, they just want to hold cash, right? Now, when they're in that state of mind, just hoarding their cash, do you really think lowering interest rates are going to make any difference? You think if they're trying to hoard cash to cover their future debts and collapsing revenues, that they're going to borrow in order to expand business? Are they going to expand production when everywhere consumers are pulling in their horns? Interest rates aren't going to do a damn thing in this particular situation, nor will further tax cuts. It's the same thing. You're just lowering the cost of business. But look, you know, it's economics 101. You can lower the cost of capital, you know, investment, lower the cost, lower interest rates, lower the cost of capital. But if the expectations of business investors is such that their profits are falling fast, it doesn't matter if you lower the cost of investment, because their expectations of profitability, rate of return, whatever you want to call it, are collapsing faster. They'll take it and they'll hoard it. They'll sit on it. Just like they're hoarding cash and liquidity now. Okay, we'll take the tax cut and we'll sit on it. And you know, households behave the same way in this kind of a situation for most. Cut the payroll tax. Oh, yeah, cut the payroll tax. What's that going to do? Is that going to stimulate spending? No. They're going to hoard it, or they're going to use it to pay down the debt as fast as they can. But, you know, politicians and policymakers still think that cutting interest rates and taxes stimulate investment. Not in this environment. They don't understand what's going on. And most mainstream economists don't understand either. They're still thinking in 19th century economic theory terms. Hell, they haven't even read Keynes. Believe me, I know. I teach economics at a college level. And you'd be surprised how many economists have never even read Keynes. Well, of course, the consequence, you know, all this liquidity preference and dash for cash is pure Keynes 101, not Keynesian, you know, not Paul Krugman. No, Keynes himself. The classic, we're in a classic 1935 scenario that Keynes analyzed. Okay, so yeah, and then we get Donald Trump in the middle of the week saying what? What were his three proposals? Well, his three proposals were, you know, he's going to lower. Well, he's going to give more loans to small businesses, right? $50 billion, and he's going to allow them to defer taxes, and then he wants to cut the payroll tax to zero. Well, you know, he's got an ulterior motive there. You know, when he was at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland earlier this year, he was asked, and his typical shooting off the his mouth. Let it slip that when he was asked, what are you going to do about the huge trillion-dollar deficit that the U.S. has? What did he say? He said, oh, we're going to go after Social Security right after the election. Yeah. So by cutting the payroll tax, he's going to exacerbate Social Security finances, make it look like it's really busted, and thereby he'll be able to go after it easier, right? By the way, this cutting payroll tax idea was done by Obama after the last Great Recession. Had no effect, economists proved. It had no effect on stimulating consumption and investment. No net effect. Come on, look, you know, if you're out of a job, you know, you give cut the payroll tax, it doesn't do anything for you, right? You're out of a job. And even if you have a job, you cut the payroll tax, people are going to hoard it or pay down their debt. Same for business. Has no effect. All it does is wreck Social Security financing. They know that. But that's what he wants to do. Well, you know, those three measures were so minimalist. And then he overlays on top of that his statement in his TV address that he was going to stop all travel from Europe to the U.S. Didn't clarify that, oh, you know, that doesn't mean we're going to stop all freight and cargo travel, you know. But the, you know, the markets took him at his word. What? We're going to cut off trade with Europe? And that's part of the reason they plummeted 2,200 points the next day. Yeah. And then even the passenger travel ban, you know, with Europe. Oh, the UK is exempt. Well, come on, you know, all I got to do is go from Milan, Italy by train to the coast of France, take the channel under the English Channel, go to London and fly to the US if I wanted to. I mean, why exempt? Why exempt London if you're going to say no travel ban? And then he blames the the Europeans, you know? Oh, they ceded the coronavirus to the U.S. You know, before that it was, oh, the Wuhan China virus. Now it's, it must be those Europeans who are the cause of this. You know, that sounds just like Herbert Hoover in 1932. Oh, it was those Europeans that are causing the Great Depression. Not us, it's them. Yeah, he actually said that. So, that's one of the reasons the TV address was such a flop, you know? And then he lies about, reverses himself. You know, a week before the TV address, he said, oh, there's only 15 cases of coronavirus in the U.S., and that's going to go to zero. And when April comes, the hot weather will evaporate the virus. Well, now we're what? We're probably at least 2,000 cases. Now that we started testing people finally, all the numbers are going up. By the way, you know, here's a good comment. The health director for the state of Ohio said, well, we got 1,000 cases here. But you know what? She said, we believe there's 100,000 people in Ohio infected alone. This is the state health director for Ohio saying there's 100,000 cases in Ohio. Look, they're covering this stuff up, folks. Yeah, we've got tens of thousands of actual infected with symptoms and hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. already walking around with no symptoms but carrying and spreading the virus. And, you know, a week ago, Trump said, go to work. Now he's saying, stay home. And then he talks about, oh, what a great job that they've done with all the test kits, 43 million out there, you know. And then his own director of Institutes of Health there, Fauci, says, oh, we really failed in distributing these test kits. Yeah. What incompetence. What incompetence. Okay, so, you know, his measures are those three simple measures. Totally ineffective. And the working class can, get relief soon, whatever that means. And now the Democrats are trying desperately, you know, what are they proposing? Well, they're throwing up some good ideas. They've raised the idea of a 14-day paid medical leave, in other words, 14 days of sick leave. But, you know, you may not be sick. You may be carrying the virus, and you shouldn't be at work, and you should be at home, but you may not be sick. So let's call it medical leave, 14 days paid. Yeah, good idea. Not sufficient. Necessary, but not sufficient. Right. They want more unemployment insurance because, look, you know, some people may not be sick with it, may not even be carriers, but their companies have sent them home or the companies are going to have big layoffs now. You know, what are you going to do with unemployment insurance? You know, we get a paltry 6 months in this country with the lowest percentage of your take-home pay of any advanced industrial country. When it comes to unemployment insurance, not going to be enough. So the Democrats are proposing that. They're also, to their credit, refusing to agree to a payroll tax cut because they know and economists know it has no effect. It sounds good for businesses, right? Immediately, they don't have to pay 6.2%. It's just another tax cut for businesses, you see. Yeah, we've given them $4.5 trillion in tax cuts in 2018. Didn't produce any real investment. Contracted 9 months in a row. Then we gave them another $427 billion loophole extensions last year, 2019. And now Trump wants to make the $4.5 trillion permanent. And he wants to index it to inflation. In other words, you're going to get a tax cut every year if you're an investor and corporation, as long as the prices rise. You know, a COLA, cost of living adjustment index for capital gains, not for wages, but for capital gains. Okay, so what's my proposal? By the way, you can read it on Counterpunch, or you can read it on my blog, my latest posting called Trump's Dead on Arrival TV Address and My Alternative Fiscal Stimulus Program. Here's what I propose, right? First of all, a 14-day paid medical leave for those who are tested with the virus, those who have symptoms, and those who are sent home by their companies because of concern of virus spreading, you know, at the workplace. Therefore, they send people home. Also, 14-day paid medical leave for parents who have to go home because the schools are shutting down and their K through 6 kids have nowhere to go. So they have to go home. It's not their fault the schools are shutting down. Well, they have to go home, you know, because most working class folks can't afford nannies and babysitters. So that 14-day medical leave should apply not just to people with symptoms or carriers or tested, right, but people who are sent home by the companies and people who have to go home because of school shutdowns. And, you know, the government can reimburse small businesses for that cost, but the big businesses don't need reimbursement. And by the way, my proposal says this is not in lieu of your paid sick leave. If you have a union contract and you have paid sick leave, well, that should remain on the books. This is in addition to, a special to. In other words, don't let the employers use it to destroy paid sick leave negotiated contracts by unions. And employment guarantees. When people are sent home, are required to go home because the school shut down, right? They are required, employers are required to restore those workers to their same position, pay and benefits that they have. And the benefits will accrue, you know, I'm talking about pension and other benefits, accrue while they're on this leave. And by the way, the 14-day medical leave can be extended by state legislatures if necessary. What about hospital costs? You know, I wrote a piece this week called COVID-19 in a Working Class, also posted. Well, what was that about? Well, that was about how the working class can't afford not to work. And they can't afford to get tested unless it's free testing. You know, all the major countries around the world, free testing. The U.S. is the one that says, go get tested and the government will reimburse you. You think your workers are going to believe that? And if they go and get tested, then their employer will be notified by the hospital or whoever, because they can't get tested at the doctor's office. See, you got to go to hospital or clinic. I mean, there's not enough tests out there. So, you know, your doctors, and they don't want you there because, you know, what can they do for you except test you? Well, go to the hospital. Well, it costs $1,000 to go to the hospital. And even if I have insurance, you know, what I got is massive hospital costs here. That should be all paid by the government, right? And health insurance companies should be prevented for 3 years from raising their rates to recoup some of this. Unemployment benefits should be extended. And there are other company general requirements, but read my blog, jackrasmus.com, or go to Counterpunch and read my piece there on my program for fiscal stimulus. Okay, I think we're out of time. Unfortunately, I could keep talking about this for another hour. Anyway, follow us up next week. This is Alternative Visions.